I doing on here? Do I stand or do I sit?
No one's going to hold you to it.
What?
No one's going to hold you to it. Okay, I just wanted to welcome and thank Rev Rosenzweig for joining us this morning. Rev Rosenzweig is my Rebbe in YU, and I gained a tremendous amount of learning and direction in life. And we thank him for making time for being here at Israel now, and for making the time for us this morning. So just to clarify the schedule, Rev Rosenzweig is going to begin with a little different hashkafa, and then question and answer. Then there'll be a break for people to learn for his shir at 12 o'clock. The makoros were sent out last night, and Rav Hashem will arrange meetings with Rev Rosenzweig at that point. Thank you again. Thank you to Rabbi Cohen for bringing him.
Okay. Thank you very much, first of all, to Hosea B'Kvod Atzanya. First of all, to thank Rav Terrigan for inviting me. It's always a pleasure, as I've said in other places, but because it's relevant in all of them, to be in Makomos Torah that my Talmidim have such important, prominent roles and impact. Is for me a tremendous source of nachas, and it also gives me a great sense of confidence that all the people who are in different programs are in very good hands, because I'm very intimately aware of the talents and the special hashkafa and the bonds that are created by your Ramim and by Rav Terrigan and the other Ramim here. I've been coming here for many years, and I've had many Talmidim who studied here in Yeshivat HaKotel, so it's really very special for me to, on these visits, to reconnect with these Yeshivot. And even as I look around the room, we have some, Bogrim, people who have been in my share for a number of years, and some more recently, and some, quite a few years past. And that sense of Mesorah, of continuity, as I say, is very very meaningful to me. Okay. So I think what we usually do is start with a little bit of Divrei Hashkafa, and then that transitions into questions and answers, which I'm happy to do. And in terms of the timing, I'll leave it up to, however long, you all want to go. So I'll try to not be so long in the first part. So this week's Parsha, of course, is Parshas Vayishlach. And, primarily the focal point of the Parsha coming up is the relationship between, Yaakov and Esav. And, the reality is that that relationship is such a dominant one that, Chazal see it as, paradigmatic. And, they say things like, halacha, biyadua, or biyadua halacha, she Esav sone as Yaakov, and there's a lot of, Edom and the relationship between Esav and Yaakov, two brothers, twins, who are so distant from each other from the very beginning. All of that is obviously very foundational as paradigms in relationships, with the rest of the world. However, it's fascinating that I'm not going to speak about that right now. That's a very large topic. It's fascinating to speak about, especially with the burgeoning anti-Semitism, worldwide, highlighted or triggered or further triggered by events here and the Eitz Tzara, which we are, undergoing. But I'm not going to speak about that topic. But what I do want to highlight is that before we actually get into the revisited relationship between Yaakov and Esav in this week's Parsha. So it's fascinating that Yaakov Avinu, when he reintroduces himself to Esav in a context in which, he's, very preoccupied and very concerned, that comes very clearly across in the Psukim. Vayira, lo, Vayetzer lo, Chazal say that, he's planning, for all contingencies, as one must in a time of, urgency and emergency, b'tfila, b'doron, he's doing his, b'mochama, he's doing his ishtadlus, he's, trying to manage the situation politically and militarily, in terms of tfila, all the things that, we're trying to do right now. But when he's so concerned and he's so anxious about this relationship, but when he reintroduces himself to Esav, he invokes his relationship with another problematic character, one who played a very dominant role, you know, just in the immediate. Is that me again? Yeah, they're always, people are always after me. Oh, okay, I'll get that for later. Another person who plays such a preeminent role in his life, and of course, especially in last week's Parsha Vayetze, that of course is Lavan. And it's fascinating that he, you know, kind of burnishes his credentials, you know, almost as if to tell Esav, I'm, you know, prepared to contend with you, and we know how, as I say, concerned he is with all of that, by invoking, you know, his previous experience, you know, with Lavan. And of course, he says in Lavan Garti, "Va'echar ad ata," and famously, Rashi quoting Chazal, say in Lavan Garti, "I lived with Lavan, v'taryag mitzvos shamarti, v'lo lamadati mimasav haroi." So it seems like, you know, this introduction, especially with everything, you know, that is at stake, and everything we know about, you know, Yaakov Avinu's state of mind, seems to be rather surprising. I mean, he finished the Parsha of Lavan. What does Lavan really mean to Esav, and what is he trying to convey? Moreover, you know, the Taryag Mitzvah Shamarti part, which is the famous part, you know, school children all learn that at a very young age, which they should, they imbibe that. Meaning I've been living with Lavan, and I'm still Yaakov Avinu. I have principles. I've been able, you know, to withstand the pressures and to fortify myself, you know, from Lavan. You know, he hasn't transformed me, even though the environment in which I've been living has been a challenging one. As if to tell Esav, meaning I'm a much, you know, more developed, I'm a stronger person, I know how to, you know, contend, you know, with love-unlike people and stay principled at the same time. And clearly that is what he is trying to convey, and that's important in his confrontation, you know, with Esav, with everything that he's concerned about. But the additional words, to me, are even more intriguing. Taryag mitzvah shamarti, v'lo lamadati mimasav haroi. So if you look at the Rashi literature in the 16th century, all of a sudden, you know, there was this, like, burgeoning, you know, Rashi literature, the Mizrahi and the Maral, you know, and the Ein Yaakov and others. Part of the Ein Yaakov project was also, you know, kind of focused on Rashi. Anyway, so there's discussion, what is this addition, V'lo lamadati mimasav haroi? But I have my own personal take on it. I don't know if other people say it or not, and that's what I want to share with you. Sometimes it's possible to be in an environment, and, you know, it's always challenging to be in a cultural environment, you know, which is different and which is founded on different principles. And again, you know, living as we do through monumental events, you know, it becomes even more apparent how difficult it is to, you know, to handle the winds of, or the currents, you know, of popular culture. And sometimes to be countercultural, which is what we need to be in order to be principled. And sometimes, you know, that requires, you know, that we introspect and that we recommit to certain things. So the minimal part is taryag mitzvot shamarti. You have to be principled and you have to, you know, carry out the obligations of the halacha, no matter what the challenges and the problems and the difficulties are, no matter how, you know, much criticism there is and how much you become, you know, an outcast. But more than that, the challenge of, you know, living in a society, you know, which isn't fully consonant, and even more so, a society which in part, or, you know, as the parts become larger, is antagonistic, you know, to a Torah way of life, extend beyond fulfilling the mitzvos technically, you know, basically being committed to Orthodox practice. They also require of us, even more so, and this is a greater challenge, right, to fortify our values and our principles so that we're not just technically consistent, you know, with the needs or the requirements of the halakha, but that our worldview, our values, are shaped by that very commitment. And I think that that is exactly what Yaakov Avinu was saying to Esau. You know, that not only, you know, am I consistent and, you know, outwardly, externally, you know, faithful you know, tarig mitzvah shamarti, but more than that, velo lamadati mimaso aron, meaning I'm unscathed, you know, when it comes to the values, you know, that Lavan represents. So everybody's familiar with the leitmotif in the writings of the Ramban ala Torah, where the Ramban writes a number of places, you know, that beyond the details of the Torah, which are vast, right, there is an ethos, there is a culture, there's a value system, you know, that the Torah promotes as well. And that's, of course, the most famous one is the Ramban's comment on Kedoshim Tiyu, you know, Al Tehish Naval versus HaTorah, where he basically points out that you could be perfectly consistent in adhering to, you know, every one of the Torah. You could say, you know, Im Lavan Garti Vitarya Gitzis Shamarti. He doesn't quote that one as well. I'm connecting it. And at the same time, you could be a Naval versus HaTorah. If you basically are just technically loyal, and if you don't draw the lessons in terms of the moral and ethical and sanctity values, you know, of the Torah itself. And, you know, you can abuse the system even as technically you are within and compliant, you know, with that system as well. And that's what Kedoshim Tiyu comes to teach you. Says, you know, of course, the minimum is to, you know, be punctilious in your performance of the mitzvos. But ultimately, that's just, you know, the first step. And maybe it's even in some respects, this sounds peculiar, but it's really true, it may be the easier step. But to be countercultural, to be consistent with Torah values, even when all around you, you know, there are, you know, other prevailing cultural winds, that is much more difficult. And that requires Kedoshim Tiyu, a commitment beyond to transcendence and to sanctity, al tehi naval b'shus haTorah. It requires of us that we also understand deeply what being compliant with the mitzvos really implies. And in the end of the day, extracting those principles and applying them in our lives as well. And that, of course, is what the Ramban you know, discusses in Devarim, you know, in a choshen mishpat, you know, context, lest one think that, you know, this principle of the Torah, you know, being more than, you know, about performance, but to be about extracting the values and applying them as well, that is, you know, limited to, you know, Iser Beheter, or even Ishus, maybe, or Achayim. So, you know, the Ramban on the Pasuk Vasisa Yashar Vahatov, you know, notes that that's a very broad mandate. Do the good and the just, or the good and the right, however the psukim are supposed to be translated. Ramban says, what's the point of that? I mean, you have numerous psukim that tell you, you know, the good things and the righteous things that you should be doing. So what's the point of another pasuk, which is, you know, seems to be simply klali, saying v'yasisa yashar v'tov? Says the Ramban, you know, that this is connected to that same doctrine. And the idea is that, you know, well, the Ramban there actually focuses more on, like, the Torah couldn't or wouldn't, Ramban says couldn't, spell out every single contingency, like, that would, you know, occur to people. And, you know, basically provide guidance, you know, in every single circumstance, every challenge, you know, every anomalous situation which was going to, you know, take place over history. Torah was given, you know, for, you know, Nitzchius. It was given, you know, to be eternal. And even in Yemos HaMashiach, according to the way we pass from like Shmuel, that, you know, Ein Bein Olam Hazeh Yemos HaMashiach HaRashim B'Malchios Bilvad. So, you know, the Torah was intended to apply to life, you know, over the millennia and in different geographic locations and with different, you know, challenges, whether they're cultural challenges or you know, challenges of survival, you know, emotional existential challenges, physical existential challenges. So the Ramban says the Torah wasn't going to or couldn't spell out every situation. So it gives you the foundations through the halakha, and you're supposed to be able to extract the principles and then to apply them, you know, in a way that is consistent, you know, where the spirit of the law, I guess you would say, consistent with the technical letter of the law. I always thought that there's more to it, and that it's not just the Torah couldn't, I mean, the Torah is, you know, very remarkable. It's the Dvar Hashem. So it can do many remarkable things. But even if it could, probably, you know, the question is whether it would. Meaning, man also has to take responsibility, Klal Yisrael, as the recipients of the Torah. You know, there's a kind of a dialectic. There's the giving of the Torah and there's the receiving of the Torah. We're not close to Shavuot, so we're not going to speak about that right now. But there's Matan Torah and there's Kabbalah Satorah. And, you know, there's enough evidence that these, of course, are connected, but that they're also, you know, somewhat distinctive. Klal Yisrael was meant to be the junior partner of the Ribbono Shel Olam in receiving of and the applying of and the living of the halacha. And as such, it's important to understand that V'asisa Yashar V'atov, that even if the Torah could have spelt out, could have written the Shulchan Aruch for you to tell you in every single circumstance throughout all the generations with all the crazy, you know, confluences and convergences that take place, you know, and all the shilas that would come up, it could give you an answer, what I call a sif katan in the Shulchan Aruch for everything. Probably there is advantage, you know, for there being some ambiguity in terms of man's role, you know, as a junior partner, meaning fully a mitzuvah, you know, who receives the Torah and, you know, immerses himself in it and surrenders to it, but then becomes an insider and someone who, you know, has a right to an opinion as an insider does. And the point is that by not spelling everything out, by giving you enough sifei katan, you know, to guide you in many things and also to provide patterns and principles, the Torah really demands more from us, and in the end of the day, that is a more effective vehicle, ironically, that if you actually did have a Sif Katan everywhere and anything. And of course, that is also the Ramban's famous view when he talks about the mitzvahs aseh of Shabbos, you know, Shabbaton, or Tishbos. The, you know, there are numerous views in the Medrash, Medrash Halacha, the regular Medrash, but especially Medrash Halacha is important, the Sifrei, the Mechilta, you know, and numerous Gemaras, you know, that seem to speak about the mitzvah aseh, you would say, of Shabbos or of Yom Tov, applying to what we know to be shvusim, you know, or mitzvahs drabanan. Like, you, if you violate this mitzvah drabanan, then you have also violated, you know, the aseh doraisa of Shabbos or of Yom Tov. And of course, the Rishonim all struggle with this. That's a very peculiar idea. Rashi, in some places, suggests that maybe it's an asmachta. The Ramban thinks maybe it's an asmachta in some places, but in Parshas Emor, famously, the Ramban says, I had an epiphany. You know, I realize now what the real pshat is, and that is that there are some dinim that are technically drabanan, right, but they reflect a doraisa principle about the spirit of the law of Shabbos. So something can be a drabanan, but once the rabbanan have kind of identified it as something which highlights, you know, the attitude toward Shabbos, things like we'll do the call and other things. So then to violate that, you know, it's not just a slap in the face for the chachamim, but it basically becomes an egregious breach of Shabbos, because if the chachamim have identified this as like a fault line, you know, as an area which reflects our deeper, you know, appreciation of what Shvisas Shabbos is all about. So while the technical action that you do is only drabanan, it touches on the doraisa. So this is, of course, one shita, and, you know, the Ramban connects these three pieces. But if you read the Ramban on the Torah, which is a great idea anyway, you know, put it in your, you know, to-do, your, was it a bucket list, they say, your to-do list. It's not something you could do in one sitting, probably, but, you know, make it a project for like a year, every parsha, or 2 years if it takes that long. It's well worth your while. So if you look at the Ramban in his Perush al HaTorah, this idea, you know, that the halacha is a foundation for, you know, perspective on life, you know, is, of course, a leitmotif. It's an undercurrent, and it has many, many, many expressions. So the truth is, you know, that this is deeply connected to what it is that we're all, you know, doing here, you know, here in Yeshivat HaKotel, you know, but also in any other classical yeshiva. you know, we say Talmud Torah is keneged kulam, that, you know, Talmud Torah is supreme value of the Torah. And the question, of course, is why? And there are various explanations or various facets of Torah's supremacy or preeminence, you know, that we could talk about, but we want to make this a little shorter. So I'm going to skip to just one aspect, and that's this aspect. In the end of the day, you know, if we focus on the details of the halacha, which we need to, because that's, you know, that's the basic, that's the core. But if we need to also go beyond, we need to extract values and a hashkafa sakayim and a way of life, then, like, what's the methodology and how do we do that? Like, how do we immerse ourselves in the laws of Shabbos so that we can figure out what really is a violation of the mitzvah saseh and what is not? Or at least, you know, have a voice in that or have some, you know, general idea of that. And how do we know, you know, when we're being a naval, you know, Birshus HaTorah? You know, and how do we know, you know, what Yashar and Tov mean if the Torah doesn't spell it out for us? And the answer in the end of the day is only, you know, by immersing ourselves in the texts of the Torah, in the details of the Torah, attaching ourselves to its wisdom. And that's what Talmud Torah, and especially Talmud Torah Bi'iyun, you know, is really all about. The more you understand a topic, a theme, the connection between the details, etc., the more you are in a position to maximize your Avodas Hashem and to be able to say not just, you know, Taryag Mitzvah Shamarti, but below, you know, Lamanati, you know, Mimas of, you know, Haroi. The truth is that Lavan, you know, wasn't just a trickster. He was a trickster, but Chazal say, number one, he was a particularly clever or adept trickster. Like, if you're going to be a trickster already, you know, being an adept and a, you know, an effective one is even more dangerous. He was a very subtle one. You know, he was, he tried to work, you know, within the system, you know, and to manipulate it from within, you know, and that's why, you know, Hichlif Maskurti, you know, so many monim. You know, Lavan was somebody who knew how to manipulate the system, and that's the most insidious type. And in a way, the manipulation of a system is exactly the opposite. I mean, that's what being a Nabal Birshus, you know, in his case it wasn't HaTorah, but whatever the system was, you know, he knew how to play the angles, as they say. He knew how to use the system, you know, against itself and to exploit it and to use it, you know, cynically. And that's what, you know, Yaakov Avinu was exposed to, you know, day in and day out. We say, you know, Arami Oved Avi, and the Parsha that we read, you know, in the middle of, you know, the Haggadah, you know, in Sibri Tzias Mitzrayim, you know, we're Doresh the Parsha of Bikurim, which begins Arami Oved Avi. You know, we say, Bikesh Lavan Lakar Sakal. Like, what does it mean? What did Lavan do that was so terrible? I mean, clearly he wasn't a very nice man. All the, you know, the Pshuto Shel Mikra makes that clear, and Chazal make it even, you know, clearer. But, you know, Bikesh Lakar Sakal, and such a focus on the night of Sibri Tzias Mitzrayim. And the Rambam says that, you know, being Doresh Parsha Sarami Oved Avi, you know, is, you know, kind of a mini Talmud Torah, you know, esque, you know, Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim, you know, in its own right, like a microcosm. Rambam uses the expression, you know, called Doresh Parsha Zu, you know, called a Marich Hareza Meshubach. You know, doesn't say that anywhere in the Gemara, that the Rambam's take. And there are many other indications of this as well. But the answer, I think, is, again, that was what was so dangerous about Laban was that he really was the antithesis of this principle. And therefore, it was critical that Yaakov Avinu, Yisrael, you know, as he's encountering even a bigger challenge, the challenge of Esav, which is, again, Esav represents, you know, a certain kind of... Laban wasn't a civilization. Laban was an individual. But Laban, on an individual level, you know, presented, you know, this challenge of somebody, you know, who might be technically within the law, you know, but, as I say, really knows how to undermine it, you know, in an insidious, cynical way from within. And as, you know, Yaakov faces an even greater enemy and challenge, one that's going to be an eternal enemy, one that has been, you know, a challenge from his very beginning, you know, but that's what it means, you know, from the very beginning when they were, before they were born, and the struggle over the Bechora, and, you know, the story with the selling of the Bechora, and then the Brachos, and everything that follows, and that's why it's Vayira and Vayetzer. There's so much at stake in the confrontation between Yaakov and Esav, so the introduction, you know, of Yaakov to say to Esav, in Lavan Garti, you know, Vo'echar an Ata, V'taryag Mitzvah Shamarti, that's already a big step. But to be able to say even further, you know, V'lo Lamadati Mimasa Varayim, you know, that, you know, his insidious, cynical approach, you know, didn't touch me. And not only was I, you know, loyal to Taryag Mitzvos, but, you know, I was able, you know, to keep them in a Kedoshim Tiyu Mitzvah Sase, you know, Vasisa Hayashar, you know, kind of a way, I'm a formidable, you know, serious, you know, not rival, but, you know, it'll take a lot, it won't take me in your capacity, you know, to negate or neutralize, you know, that level, you know, of my commitment. And that's why, you know, Chazal, some of them understand that, you know, Yaakov Avinu spent time with Lavan, you know, and, you know, originally it was supposed to be a short amount of time. You know, and then it, you know, lingered on and on and on. And, you know, and he said, you know, ain panav, you know, kitzmol shil shon. You know, all the darshanim say, you know, that means two things. Number one, you know, Lavan, he said, like, Lavan's not looking at me the same way. But, you know, all the darshanim say, it's a good vort, as they say. But, you know, what really troubled him was, I'm not looking at Lavan the same way. Like, when I first met Lavan, it was obvious that he was a trickster, you know, that he was somebody, you know, to be wary of. You know, I've been in his environment, you know, for a long time and maybe for too long. And, you know, I don't have this, I'm not revolted as much, you know, by, you know, his essence, you know, as I was. And that's when it became, you know, time to leave. But Yaakov Avinu was able to take that initiative. And therefore, he was able to say with pure conviction, you know, as he confronted, you know, an even greater challenge, Im Lavan Garti, Taryag Mitzvah Shamarti, Vo Lamadati Mimasav Haroi. So I think this is really important. It's important for, you know, all ages and all circumstances. Yaakov is, you know, the Bechira Avos, he's Tiferes, he's the one who combines, you know, the best, you know, of Abraham and Yitzchak, you know, the Amud HaChesed and the Amud HaGevura to give you the perfect blend of Tiferes. He's also Yaakov and he's Yisrael. Kisarisa imo Elokim ve'imo anashim batuchal. You know, he has his Yitzchak side, his Pachad Yitzchak side, and his okay, Avicha side. We're not going to elaborate on that. And he's, you know, his journey, including his time with Lavan, not what he learned from Lavan, but what he learned, you know, as, you know, to be antithetical to Lavan, and, you know, his refinement of Taryag Mitzvah Shamarti, impressive enough, but even more, V'lo Lamadati Mimasav Harayim, in the end of the day, you know, that's who Yaakov Yisrael, you know, really is. And therefore, you know, each of us, Ma'aseh Avosim and Lavanim, who are his, you know, extended children, you know, it's important that we internalize this message. And throughout our history, there have been many crises, and we've been in many, you know, hostile environments, sometimes, you know, obviously hostile, things that, you know, again, we're on the cusp right now of the holiday of Hanukkah. Everybody keeps saying to me, you should speak about Hanukkah, but we're not there yet. You know, it's no din of Shloshim Yom, I think, for Hanukkah. So we're excited, and we're looking forward to it. But so we can mention it for sure. The Hanukkah story was, of course, a challenge of Taryag Mitzvos Shamarti. Like, there were things that you just weren't, you know, allowed to do. And it was a kind of Shas Hashmad, you know, situation. You're learning, you know, Ksubas, so you're already familiar with that sugya from the beginning of Ksubas. I'm not going to discuss that right now. But it is relevant, but I'm not going to discuss it. But in the end of the day, you know, throughout our history, we've had, you know, situations where we weren't allowed to do mitzvahs. We've had situations where our physical lives were threatened by wars and by, barbaric actions, etc. And we've had situations in which our cultural matrix has been, you know, threatened. Well, we live in an environment, and that of course is part of the Hanukkah story, you know, as well. That's really what the misyabanim and the real threat was, which is one of the reasons why, you know, we really do focus, you know, not so much on the military victory, but on the Nes Pach HaShemen, again, not for now, but because there's an understanding that while there was, you know, a crisis of survival, but as the Lubush and as the Bach and others point out, the real danger was, you know, to the spiritual integrity, you know, of Klal Yisrael. It was a cultural war, a Kulturkampf, you know, as they sometimes say. So in that sense, you know, being sustained by the image of Yaakov Avinu, of Tariq Mitzvah Shamarti below Lamadati Mimas of Haroim, that becomes very critical. And of course, our time is no different. And, you know, right now we're acutely in the middle of a crisis, of a military crisis, a physical crisis, an existential crisis of survival here in Eretz Yisrael, in Medinas Yisrael, etc. But, you know, worldwide, you know, it has triggered, you know, anti-Semitism in a very significant way, as I mentioned earlier. But not just anti-Semitism, or what's connected with the anti-Semitism is really, I think, in some respects, even more disturbing, and that is a profound, like, cultural dissonance, you know, between the truths of Yaakov and the Lolamadati Mimas of Haroim, and a lot of the prevailing culture in terms of, you know, what they prize and you know, how they see, you know, fact and fiction, and what they value, you know, in terms of morality, what constitutes morality, the inability of, you know, places of higher education, the highest education in the world, you know, and especially, I'm focusing especially on the United States, but it's true even more so about Europe. The fact that, you know, campuses have deteriorated, you know, morally, you know, to the extent that, you know, the anti-Semitism is, you know, rampant, but even more than that, that, you know, that people can chant, you know, calls and they can, you know, be bloodthirsty and, you know, even as they're ignorant of facts, or facts just don't really matter, all these are not just, you know, existential physical threats. They are. But, you know, as I say, they mask a much, I think, more insidious challenge, and that is the cultural threat. You know, what is truth and falsehood? What is integrity? What is morality? And it's not enough for us, you know, simply to say, you know, Tariag Mitzvah Shamarti. That too is challenging. The real challenge of the moment is to be so immersed in our learning and in our values and so inspired by them, you know, that we can also say, Velo Lamadati Mimas of Haroim, and we can, in the marketplace of ideas, you know, not only remain steadfast with the integrity that is required, but also be, you know, when possible at least, you know, a force for good. But the way of doing that is really to deepen our understanding of, you know, Masechet Ksuvos, or Brachos, or Yevamos. I don't know if there's anybody here, but and so on. And that's really what, you know, all of you are doing in this yeshiva and in other, you know, wonderful yeshivot. And the opportunity to learn from, you know, your Rabbeim, you know, some of whom are my Talmidim, and even the ones who aren't are just very special people, and who understand, you know, have their own way of formulating these issues, but who understand it very deeply, and who, you know, live and breathe it, and who convey it in their own way, you know, is really a very special, makes this a very special time in your lives. So I just want to wish everybody Hatzlacha, to go Mechayel Ochayel, and take, you know, the opportunity as it presents itself, you know, to be here in Eretz Yisrael in this special time, a time of, you know, great concern, but also a time of achdus, thankfully, and a time which kind of sharpens, you know, what is singular about Yaakov and Yisrael, and to, you know, to recommit to that, you know, and to be good ambassadors for it as well. Thank you. Okay, I've said my piece. If you want, anybody wants to ask questions, I am happy to try to respond. Yeah.
It sounded like they're always saying that Torah seems like a means to an end.
Say again?
That Torah seems like a means to an end, that you learn Torah in order to get to become a certain type of person, or that demonstrate a certain type of shkafa. Is the Torah an end in itself at all, or really just as a means to an end?
I would say two things. First of all, I think I alluded to the fact that there are many facets of Torah, some of which I wasn't going to speak about now because of the time. So you're quite right. What I was speaking of may sound like a more instrumental approach. Surely, just attaching yourself to Dvar Hashem itself. I mean, the Gemara says in Brachos, Tafalef Amin Aleph, that Birchas HaTorah. The bracha that you make on the study of Torah is based on the pasuk, again at the end of Devarim, Kishem Hashem Ekra HaBugodel Elokeinu. And the Ramban in his Hakdama to Perush on Torah says that the Torah is Shemosav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I believe the Ramban himself in Sefer Mitzvos says that Birchas HaTorah is one of the Tariyah Mitzvos, separate from even Talmud Torah, based on this pasuk, Hashem Hashem Ekra HaBugod LaLokeinu. So it's a very curious thing. What is Hashem Hashem Ekra? When I call out the name of the Ribbono Shel Olam, Havu Godel, LaLokeinu, what does that have to do with Birchas HaTorah? And what does Ramban mean when he says that the Torah is the names of the Ribbono Shel Olam? Probably has a mystical element to it, but probably has more than that as well. It doesn't say, oh, Al Derech HaEmes, So if you're skipping the Kabbalah, skip this part. He wants you to read this part. He also wants you to read the Kabbalah part, but that's something else. So I think that the answer is that, what the Ramban is telling us is that, like Rabbeinu Yonah says, but Rabbeinu Yonah says it in a more targeted way, the Pasuk says in Yirmiyah, haskel v'yadoa osi, that the way that you understand the Ribbono Shel Olam is by learning his Torah. And I think that's what the Ramban, what the Ramban understands, that's what the Gemara is saying. A name is a way to connect to somebody, to identify them, to understand them. So Talmud Torah is connected kulam, in part, because the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the Torah. The Torah is also perceived to be like the blueprint of the world. Stako baraisa bara, alma, things like that. So by attaching ourselves to it, we attach ourselves to him. So basically, immersion in the study of Torah is, studying the Ribbono Shel Olam, but also it's simply bonding and binding yourself to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that surely is something that is intrinsic. However, let me just add, I did focus more on Talmud Torah in what seems to be a more instrumental role, like it's the basis of our value system, etc. And I think it's interesting that you asked the question the way that you did. But what I would argue is, when the goal or the vehicle is about defining, what it means to be living a meaningful and purposive life, then that kind of instrumentality is not an instrument and it's not a vehicle. It becomes almost identical, with an intrinsic connection and bond. Meaning, what we're describing in this seemingly instrumental way is the idea, not of like being pragmatically instrumental, like, I want to get some benefit, so, if I want to, make money in the stock market, so, it's important that I understand, how it all works, how the market works, how much panic works, volatility. I don't want to give a whole, Cy Sims stock market speech right now, hopefully because I'm not capable of it, but the point is that, or anything else. I want to be a physician, so I have to go to medical school, I have to study the body, and so on and so forth. But here, we're talking about something, on a different level completely. What we're talking about is trying to extract values from the norms and details of the Torah so that we can be one, right, with the Torah's purpose and message itself. It's what the Rav in his writings, the article that he wrote, the Rav didn't publish very much, in his lifetime, and until, for many, many, many years, until he was in his, 60s, he basically had like one or two, you know, published essays. He was very prolific, you know, in his teaching and in the ideas that he presented. And but, you know, his Torah Shebichsav, we'll say, until he was in his 60s, was very, very limited. But, you know, the seminal article that he wrote, of course, is the Ish Halacha. And the principle of the Ish Halacha is the idea that, you know, the Halacha, again, you know, it's, he doesn't quote the Ramban, interestingly, in that piece. But it's, you know, kind of the next step, you know, from it, which is, again, that the Halacha isn't something we simply are compliant with. The Halacha is the prism through which we analyze and evaluate and apply all issues in our lives, meaning it is an all-encompassing, self-defining, you know, mechanism. So what I was describing before, which is that, you know, Talmud Torah, Iyun, is the way that we understand, you know, what the Halacha really embodies, and of course, minimally, therefore, what we need to do, but also what we then need to internalize as part of our, you know, fundamental personality. It may sound, like a facilitation or an instrumentality, but at the end of the day, since the goal is to be basically a walking Sefer Torah, right, it's probably the highest, aspiration, you know, of having an intrinsic, you know, perspective on the value of Torah itself. So the Gemara says in, you know, in Kiddushin and in Makos, you know, Gemara makes an equation between a Talmud Chacham, you know, who has invested and immersed himself, you know, in the Torah in a very pervasive way, you know, and a Sefer Torah. And that's what they mean, that somebody who, you know, whose immersion and whose investment and whose self-image, you know, and whose, you know, thought processes, you know, have been taken over, he's surrendered, like, to the system, that person becomes, you know, one with and an extension of the system itself. That's exactly what I'm trying to, you know, capture. Not everybody gets, you know, to that level and to that result. But, of course, that is probably, you know, the most ambitious articulation of an intrinsic, you know, understanding of what Torah is. So it's a great question, and I think it, you know, gave me an excuse to speak about the other dimension, which I think is critical, but even more so to clarify that what I was speaking about before is a mechanism and a method, but it's a mechanism and a method that, when pursued with integrity, you know, becomes the end or the intrinsic expression, you know, of identifying with and becoming one with Torah and its values themselves. Yeah.
What is the role of a Rebbe in a Talmud's life, and what should be a Rebbe's goal?
Okay, that's a great question. Well, so, you know, we'll pick up with what we've been discussing, and that is, I mean, on a minimal level, obviously, a Rebbe should provide a guidance, and he should, you know, provide instruction, you know, methodologically, you know, how to read and how to understand and, you know, how to balance and, you know, how to know, you know, just to, you know, the ins and outs of the system of halacha, which can be very complex. And again, there are different levels of Rebbein. There are, you know, there's the Rebbe who teaches you Moda Ani, who's also very important. You know, the one who teaches you, you know, your first Rashi's, you know, Lavan Garti, you know, Vitaryag Mitzvah Shemarti. Some people teach it so well that the children, you know, come home from school, and I think that's what it says in the Psukim. They go to shul, they hear it says, you know, in Lavan Garti Ve'echar Ata, you know, they start screaming out and correcting, you know, the Baal Torah. That would be a great thing. But, you know, so those Rebbeim are very important too. They're imbuing, you know, Tinokol Shalbeis Rabban with emuna and like a deep understanding at a very young age, which is what, you know, imbibing things, you know, really means. You know, those are values too. And then there's the Rebbe who teaches you how to read Gemara, which is a hard task. It's a different language. You know, it's a different derech hachashiva. It's a different, you know, way of thinking. You know, it's very challenging to have a good Rebbe to teach you Atzcholas Gemara. And then you have Rebbeim who are teaching you how to analyze Gemara. That ultimately, when you're on the highest level, how to navigate the Yama Talmud, you know, in terms of, you know, Bikias and Iyun and Lumdus and Psak and all of these things. So on one level, obviously, the instruction itself is of great significance. And since he's mentoring you and guiding you, you know, through the labyrinth and all these different stages of Limud HaTorah. So he's more than just a teacher. He's not a professor or just an instructor. He's also that. But since the material that he's teaching you, you know, has, you know, this transcendent value, you know, in both senses that we spoke of and in the sense that they converge, which is my answer to the previous question. So already he's, you know, somebody who, to use the language of Chazal, that the Rambam, you know, also, you know, invokes in the Hilchos Talmud Torah, you know, he's Mevio, you know, L'chai Olam Haba. You know, the Rambam says, you know, if you have to be Mechabed your parents who bring you, you know, into Olam Hazeh, then certainly, Kol Shekein, you have to be Mechabed your Rabbein, you know, who are Mevio L'chai Olam Haba. And that's why a Rebbe is a father, Vishinanta Levanecha, etc. However, on the highest of levels, you know, the Rebbe is more than that as well, and in two senses. Number one, as a father figure, the Shinanta Levanecha Talmidecha, as a father figure, obviously, you know, his role goes beyond, you know, the academic. And even if the academic isn't just academic, which is what I was just describing, because it's much more than that. It's more important, it's more spiritual, it's defining, so already it isn't just academics. And these different roles overlap, and they're, you know, integrative as well, but still doesn't mean that they aren't, you know, separate facets. But, you know, since we're talking about your life and purpose of your life, so like a father, there are elements, you know, in terms of guidance and in terms of, you know, the holistic gavra, you know, beyond, you know, what he stands for, you know, that are critical as well. Like in a Rebbe, and again, let's be clear, we're talking about human beings, we're talking about fallible people, we're not talking about only the Rabbonu Shalom is perfect. And but, you know, within people's humanity and their limitations and their fallibility, you know, what you are looking for is somebody, again, who is more than the sum of his parts. And that, you know, the immersion and the investment that he has made, you know, has already, and the internalization of the halacha and its values and the experience, you know, of having, you know, prevailed, you know, through, you know, many challenges and experiences, etc., the transformation that has, you know, triggered in him, you know, all of that is who he now is, and he is your mentor, and he's a paradigm. You know, that's what we mean when we say Maisav Osev Labanim. And in that respect, you know, the idea that a Rebbe is a father and he's a persona, you know, not just a teaching machine or like a computer, you know, who knows a lot, or, you know, even one with, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, who, you know, can put together things, you know, seemingly in a creative way. But it's more than even that. It's this idea of being a personality. And that's where you get to the third step. And that is, if we're talking about somebody especially on a certain kind of level, you know, so then that person becomes like a walking Sefer Torah. He becomes an insider, you know, in the system itself. Again, in the Rav's essay, Ish Halacha, there are really like two parts. And it's really fascinating to think about it, because like the first part is all about, as I said before, like surrendering to the system and the role that the system plays, that the halacha plays in like defining, you know, how you think, you know, again, it's very beautifully written. The Rav had just, you know, amazing, capacity, you know, for writing, for expressing himself, you know, in addition to the tone of things and connected with it. But so he writes it in a very beautiful way. But the idea is, you know, all of that, that's the first part, surrendering to the system, ad kedei kach, that, like, your thinking, you know, is defined, you know, by halakhic category. Obviously, it's a very high level, and people don't always achieve it, and certainly people don't achieve it immediately, but that's the aspiration, and that's what he's, you know, in a paradigmatic, like, idealistic way, that's what he's described. But the second half of the essay is all about the importance of chiddush and the individual contribution of Talmid Chachamim. And, you know, taking what he calls, you know, the Lithuanian, you know, approach, the Litvisha approach, whatever you want to call it, but the Rav Berg speaks about the great admiration for Chiddush and the, you know, the idea that individual Talmid Chachamim, you know, kind of become part of the system, and their insights, you know, are part of the system as well. So you have to go through stage one to get to stage two. Like, if you surrender yourself to the system, then you can be an insider, you know, whose own insights, which by definition are shaped by, you know, that earlier, you know, commitment and investment, and therefore they're internal, right? That they become then his individual nofech mishalo, his personality, his experiences, his convictions, you know, that becomes an insider in the system. That's what we mean, at least how I understand it, what we mean by chachma and zorah. You know, people who, you know, are human beings, and they're transmitting it, you know, it's, you know, the Mishnah Navos. You know, it sounds like it's like a baton, you know, that you're passing from one person to another. But it's not exactly, because the baton itself, you know, is transformed, you know, in the transfer. So, and it's supposed to be, as long as it isn't done, you know, in an improper, radical, or, you know, a revolutionary way, but in an evolutionary way. So that's what being part of the Chachmei HaMesorah is about. And that's, you know, also what a Rebbe, you know, is, you know, in the end of the day. So, the Rebbe plays many functions. Some of them overlap with, you know, other mentors, you know, whether they're family mentors or academic mentors. But because, you know, the subject matter, the stakes, the methodology, the goal is so different, that already, you know, puts it on a different level. And as you get higher, you know, in these relationships, as I say, it becomes so much more than that. He becomes a persona. And, you know, more than that even, he becomes, hopefully, like the walking Sefer Torah, an insider, somebody whose own, like there's a merging of, you know, of the individual and his commitment, you know, with the material itself. Okay. I hope I answered your question. Everybody can always follow up if I didn't answer your question.
So the Rav mentioned during the speech that by not providing a siman for every situation, not guidance, and not spelling out every single situation that's come up throughout history
in detail,
as opposed
to giving principles,
right,
and, you know, requiring some, you know, personal initiative, right, and responsibility.
So the Torah allowed us to become like a junior partner, like an insider. So why is that a productive, effective thing? Like, why is that good? Why not just spell everything out?
Because again, I think at the end of the day, what I just described, you know, and again, there was no collusion here. It's not like, you know, I put him up to his question, and we've never met, right? I mean, hopefully we will in the future. But I think it can be established that there was no collusion here. But the answer lies in my previous, the answer to this question lies in my previous answer, which is that, you know, the Torah's goal was not that people should be passive and they should be robotic. You know, if the goal of the Torah was, you know, that the Rabbonu Shalom was to be like a despot, a dictator, you know, and everybody should simply surrender to his will, again, that wouldn't be despotic because he created the world, you know, and anything that he wants, Ritzon Hashem, would obviously be good. But the Ritzon Hashem that we are familiar with, let's say, is not simply that people should surrender. It's that they should surrender and that they should, as a result, be transformed and then become, you know, part of this, you know, system and this process. Otherwise, it would just be a, you know, kind of, you know, it would be a testing, you know, mechanism, you know, of your, like, how loyal are you? And we're constantly, I mean, there are those who think that, like, for example, chukim, you know, that are hard to, you know, understand, obviously, are a test. You know, they're, when Chazal say, lo nitna Torah el letzare v'sabrios, you know, so there are views in Chazal that say, you know, certain mitzvos don't have any intrinsic meaning at all, and they're just to test our loyalty and our fidelity. However, the mainstream view of Rishonim, I mean, the Rambam thinks that this is machlokes Chazal. The Ramban says, no, there's nobody who holds that way. But either way, even the Rambam, who thinks that there are people who hold that way, understandably, this is the Rambam, says, oh, we don't paskin that way. What we mean when we say, lo nitna Torah, the Tzara Tzara Tzabrios, is not that the Torah is testing you to see if you'll be compliant and you're a good servant, you're a good Eved Hashem alone. It means also that, you know, we want to refine your behavior, we want to ennoble you and elevate you, you know, so that you become transformed, you know, by the things that you do. And if we always can't always, especially in Chukim, identify how that works, or what the goal is, etc. So you have to have a little bit of faith. There are many things that we don't understand. But at the end of the day, the goal is man's elevation. So if man is not supposed to be only a robot, you know, who's surrendering his autonomy and is compliant, but he's supposed to be, you know, a person who's an Eved, you know, but even as he's an Eved, he's also an Adam, and he has free choice, and he has the capacity, you know, to be a contributor to the system. Not that the Ribbono Shel Olam needs our contribution, but what we believe is that he structured the Torah in such a way, you know, as to provide for it and to encourage it if it's done properly. So then, that's such a much more aspirational, you know, dream, you know, than just having like an amazing society of loyal followers. If your loyal followers also can internalize your message, you know, and they can carry it forward in a way, you know, that, you know, is a tribute to who you are, you know, then obviously that's a higher aspiration. It's also more fraught with danger and risk than people's ego, which is a very powerful thing. You know, their you know, self-aggrandizing natural tendencies will take over, etc. And that brings me to another point in the previous question, the last part, which I think I forgot to ignore, which I accidentally ignored, and that is, you know, what does the Rebbe want for the Talmud? Did you ask me that? Or something like that? What? What is the goal of the Rebbe? So certainly part of the goal of the Rebbe, you know, is to transmit accurately, you know, the Torah that he was given, you know, to pass the baton on accurately and responsibly. That is the first thing. All this other nuance, which I believe in very strongly, about Chiddush and the Nofech Mishalo and being, you know, one of the Chachmei Masorah, that only comes after the first part, meaning the surrender part, the precision of your, you know, conveying, you know, accurately and responsibly both the methodology and the tochen of Torah for the next generation. If you do all that, then we can talk about the second part. But the bigger point that I'm trying to make is that what the Rebbe wants from his Talmidim is that they too should be changed in the Masorah, but in both senses. You know, first, that they should understand, be loyal, be committed, you know, to the details of halacha and to the values of halacha. But, you know, his higher aspiration for them, and this is where it becomes, from an ego point of view, a little tricky. Chazal say, "Bakol, you know, adam mistkanei chutz mibno b'talmido." That, you know, people are always jealous of other people. It's an ego rivalry. It's just the reality of life. You have to work very hard on that midah. We all do. But with the exception of one's son and one's Talmud. We'll leave it at that. That's an interesting point in its own right. But the bigger point is that, you know, we want our Talmidim to be faithful followers, transmitters, but we also want them, you know, to realize their own potential, you know, and to attain within all that their own proper, you know, independence and contribution. And I always like to say, and other people told me, they've seen this, other people say this, you know, as well, which I'm very happy about, you know, that when Chazal used the expression of Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, that, you know, they use that expression, you know, very, you know, carefully. And that the idea is not just to produce many Talmidim, you know, but to Hamidu them, you know, which means to allow them, you know, to stand on their own. And that is a goal of a Rebbe when it's appropriate, and that is not only to ensure continuity, you know, but to produce proper independence and to encourage, you know, the individual talents and special, you know, potential contribution of their Talmidim as well. So again, this goes back to the robotic, you know, question too, which is like, wouldn't it just be better if everybody were just, you know, surrendering? So it's an interesting point. I'll just add another, you know, piece to it. It always struck me that if you look at Psukim and Shmos, you know, in Kabbalah Satorah, you know, so in Mishpatim, so, etc. So, you know, the one that won out in the end, like if you had to identify, you know, the slogan, you know, that reflects Kabbalah Satorah, it's, you know, Na'aseh B'Nishma, of course. But before Nasa v'Nishma in Mishpatim, you know, there's the first response of Klal Yisrael was simply Nasa. So you would think, and this is basically your question, like, isn't Nasa better than Nasa v'Nishma? Because Nasa implies a commitment, you know, without even, like, blind faith. What's better, blind faith or faith based on understanding, you know, and agreement? Like, it's an interesting question. The answer is there are elements of blind faith, you know, that are the best, you know, in the sense of loyalty. But maybe there are advantages, you know, to illumination and clarity, you know, as well. So really the Torah describes both responses, but the one that won out was the Nasa v'Nishma. But the way I understand the Nasa v'Nishma, as a Talmud of the Rav, you know, I don't think he said this, but based on this and the Ramban and everything that we've been discussing, is that, you know, it's one thing to say Nasa, and, you know, I don't think Nasa has to be robotic, but it is, it's a surrender, it's an Eved approach, and being an Eved Hashem is the first step, and that's why Nasa is even the first step of Nasa v'Nishma. But the v'Nishma part isn't, you know, a T'nai in the Nasa, that's the whole point. It's, you know, Nasa without question, but then the Nishma becomes more ambitious. The way I understand the Nishma is, the Nishma is based on the Nasa. In other words, it's a reconstruction. It's understanding as an insider what I described before, what I call the inner logic of the halakha, not that the halakha has to conform to some outer logic. Meaning it doesn't have to make sense if you're an outsider. You know, it's a reconstruction which allows you who are committed, you're an Eved, you know, to also become an enlightened Eved, you know, and to understand it from... There are many times that, even in our own experiences, I'm not going to give an example because everybody's had these experiences, where you know that an outsider, you know, if he hears something or out of context, you know, it's enigmatic and it's, you know, paradoxical or just, you know, you just can't gain access to it. But if you know the story or you were raised in a certain climate, this isn't even only in religion. You know, so then you have a background, you know, and that framework, you know, puts, you know, the issue, you know, in a completely different light. That's what Nasa v'Nishma, you know, is, and that's in the end a higher ambition and aspiration. It's being a walking Sefer Torah. It's being, you know, an insider. It's, you know, being so committed, going back to what you asked before, that it's not a vehicle, you know, and a means to an end. It's, you know, this end and this vehicle are the same. That's what Nasa v'Nishma really is. Okay, good. Next question. Oh. Yeah.
We'd like to thank Rabbi Rosenzweig for his time.
That's a great question.
Whoever signed up for a meeting, they're going to be in here starting in 1 minute.
Okay. If somebody has like a 45-second question or a question of 15, and I'll answer that, I'm game.
I think they're excited to go prepare their maromakomos now. So
terrific.
Well,
even better.
Shir at 12 o'clock.
Okay.
So we'll regroup for the ones who are coming back to the Shir calling. Otherwise, we'll allow Ari to do his topic.
Ari. Okay. Anyway, good to see you. Are you here back here or not? Am I here? It was great to see you. They wanted me to come back yesterday, but I saw too many things in the morning. I figured, I mean, you were able to come the other day.
Yeah, I think so.
What was the problem?
Rebbe was going to be there on Wednesday, so they didn't know about it. What they were.
Oh, that's so sweet. Because I told them, this is what happened. They came to me and said, oh, we want you to come to us on Monday and Wednesday. I said, listen, I'm here for, you know, less than a month. So I'm running around. I'm happy to run around. I also have some family. I have other things.